I was looking at the GDP breakdown in our source material this morning, and I just kept staring at one number. It felt wrong.
I think I know which one you mean. Is it the energy sector?
5%, yeah. Energy services, and you know, we're talking about everything.
Yeah.
The electricity for every city, the fuel in every car, every factory, the whole lifeblood of
And
civilization.
it's only 5% of global GDP.
It just sounds so counterintuitive. If it powers everything, you'd think it would be a much bigger slice of the economy.
Well, that's what makes it so dangerous. That small footprint is what macroeconomists see as the ultimate leverage point.
A leverage point.
Yes, that 5% might look small on paper, but it's the lever that can move the entire world.
And that's the perfect hook for today's deep dive. Because if you mess with that 5%, you tend to get one of two things.
Right.
You either get a huge recession, like in the 70s with the oil shocks, or
Yeah.
you get a planetary crisis.
It's the highest stakes balancing act there is. How do you keep the economy running without, well, cooking the planet?
To figure that out, we're diving into a really interesting source today. It's Chapter 25, Sustainability by Hassler, Crusell, and Olofsson. Now, I know what you're thinking.
Chapter 25 sounds a little academic, a bit dry.
It does, but it reads more like a user manual for how the planet's economy actually works. It's about the intersection of money, physics, and, you know, the environment.
And our mission really is to get our heads around these things they call integrated assessment models, IAMs.
IAM sounds a bit sci-fi.
It sounds more complicated than it is. Just think of it like a loop, a clockwise rotation, as they put it.
Okay, a clockwise rotation.
The economy pumps out carbon, which affects the carbon cycle, which changes the climate, which causes damages.
And those damages circle right back and smash the economy.
Exactly, the loop closes.
And we're going to break down that loop, but I want to be clear for you listening, we're skipping the heavy calculus. We want to get to the logic, the thinking that actually drives global climate policy.
Right, the incentives. Why does the market, which is so good at so many things, fail so completely when it comes to the climate?
So let's start there. Section one, the source uses this great visual, this analogy to explain it. It's all about property rights.
This is figure 25.1 in the text. It's a diagram of the world colored in different shades of gray.
And land is colored dark gray.
Because it has strong property rights. I mean, someone owns it. A farmer owns their field. So they have a huge incentive to take care of it, right? If they ruin their soil, they lose their asset.
Simple enough. But then you get to the climate in this diagram.
And the atmosphere is the lightest gray.
Because nobody owns it.
Nobody. You can't put a fence around the stratosphere. So what happens when a resource is free?
It becomes a dumping ground.
A total free-for-all. I get the benefit of running my factory, but the cost, the smoke that just gets spread out among everyone else.
That's the classic negative externality.
It is. I privatize the profits, but I socialize the costs. And that's the broken cog that starts the whole IAM rotation.
Okay, so let's walk through that rotation again, step by step. Step one is the economy.
Firms burn fossil fuels to make things, to create GDP.
Step two, the carbon cycle.
That burning releases CO2, which enters the atmosphere and, it mixes globally. Doesn't matter where you burn it, it all goes into the same tub.
Which leads to step three, the climate.
The greenhouse effect. The CO2 traps heat.
And then step four, damages.
The heat comes back to bite us. More storms, rising sea levels, failing crops. And all of that, of course, hurts the economy. It destroys infrastructure, it lowers productivity.
And what's wild is that economists try to put a number on every single part of that loop. They're asking, how many dollars of GDP do we lose for every single degree of warming?
And to do that, you have to get into the science, into the physics of forcing.
This is Arrhenius's greenhouse law, right?
Yeah, Svante Arrhenius, he figured this out back in the 1890s. It's basically a logarithmic function.
Logarithmic. So the more you add, the less impact each new bit has. Like the first blanket helps a lot, the 10th, not so much.
No.
That's true for the individual molecule. But, and this is a huge aha moment in the chapter, when you look at the entire system, scientists found something they call the CCR.
The constant carbon climate response.
For years, everyone thought the relationship was super complex. But it turns out it's long. It's surprisingly linear.
Linear, a straight line.
A straight line. Cumulative emissions are directly proportional to temperature rise. You emit X amount of carbon, you get Y amount of warming. Simple as that.
Why is a straight line scarier than a curve?
One word, irreversibility. Because it's a straight line, every ton of carbon you emit adds a permanent notch to the global temperature. It doesn't wash away.
So it's not like inflation where the Fed can raise rates and maybe it comes back down.
No, this is a ledger, and you can never erase a line from it. To stop the warming, you can't just slow down emissions. You have to get to zero.
That's sobering.
It means we have a very strict carbon budget. The IPCC estimates that for every 1,000 gigatons of carbon we emit, the temp goes up by somewhere between 1.0 and 2.3 degrees Celsius.
Okay, so let's do the math. Where are we now?
Since the Industrial Revolution, we've burned about 650 gigatons.
So if the budget is roughly 1,000, and we've already burned through 650.
We are well over halfway there.
Yeah.
And burning through the rest of it very, very quickly.
Which brings up that argument you always hear. You know the one, don't worry, peak oil will save us. We'll run out of oil before things get too bad.
The supply side argument, yeah, that nature will just take the keys away before we crash the car.
Yeah. Does the data back that up?
Not at all. The source spends a lot of time on this. They distinguish between reserves and resources.
What's the difference?
Reserves are what we know is there and what's profitable to drill right now. Resources are, well, everything else that's in the ground, even if it's hard or expensive to get to.
Okay. So let's look at oil.
If we burned all the conventional oil reserves, all the easy stuff, the source says it would only add about 0.13 to 0.33 degrees Celsius.
Wait, that's it? Just that?
That's it. It's bad, sure. But it's not the apocalypse scenario.
So if it's not the oil, what is it?
The villain of this entire story is coal. The reserves alone are massive, over 1,000 gigatons. But the resources, the amount that's technically down there, it's just staggering.
I'm looking at the number here, and it looks like a typo. If we burned all available coal resources, global temperatures would rise by at least 10 degrees Celsius.
10 degrees.
I can't even picture what 10 degrees means. I know 2 degrees is dangerous. What's 10?
10 is an uninhabitable planet. That's not a recession. That is an extinction-level event.
So the idea that we'll just run out is a total myth.
A complete myth. The constraint can't be supply. We have to choose to leave it in the ground. It has to be policy.
Okay, so if it has to be a policy, we have to weigh the costs. And this seems to be where the big economic debate is.
It is. How do you actually measure the damage? The source lays out two camps, bottom up versus top down.
Bottom up. That sounds like you add everything up piece by piece.
Exactly. That's the William Nordhaus method. You make a list.
Yeah.
You add up the cost of lost crops, plus the cost of flooded cities, plus the cost of more heat stroke.
And when you tally it all up,
you often get surprisingly low numbers. Some of those models say 2 degrees of warming would cost less than 1% of global GDP.
Less than a percent? For changing the climate of the entire planet. That feels way too optimistic.
A lot of people argue it is.
Yeah.
That it misses the bigger systemic risks. So the other approach is top down.
How does that work?
Instead of counting disasters, you just look at the macro data. Mm-hmm. You ask, how does heat itself affect GDP growth? Do economies just run slower when it's hot?
And they do.
The studies suggest they do, and those numbers are much scarier. Some show that poor countries can lose 1% of their growth rate for every 1 degree of warming.
And that compounds. Losing 1% a year for decades is huge.
It's devastating. It creates massive global instability.
So, okay, we've got a range of damage estimates, but the solution proposed is an old one, right? The Pigou tax.
Arthur Pigou, 1920s. The idea is simple. You should pay a tax equal to the damage you cause. It's the you break it, you bite it rule for the economy.
So if a gallon of gas causes $2 in climate damage, the tax should be $2.
In a perfect world, yes. It forces the price to reflect the true social cost.
But here's the really tricky part. To calculate that tax, you have to decide how much the future is worth.
The discount rate. Beta. This is the philosophical core of the whole debate.
Yeah, let's slow down on this because it's so important. It's asking a pretty brutal question, isn't it?
It is. Is a dollar of damage in the year 2125 worth the same as a dollar of damage today?
How much would you pay me today to stop me from stealing $100 from your great-great-grandson?
That's the question. And there are two very different answers. The Nordhaus view uses market interest rates, a discount factor of about 0.985.
Which basically says the future is cheaper.
Right. It assumes people in the future will be richer and have better technology, so we don't need to sacrifice as much for them now.
But then there's the Stern review.
Lord Nicholas Stern. He says this isn't about markets, it's about ethics. He uses a discount factor of 0.999. He says a person born in 2100 matters almost as much as we do.
We shouldn't discount their suffering just because they aren't born yet.
Exactly. And that tiny change in the math from 0.985 to 0.9999, it flips the entire policy recommendation.
From a modest tax to a massive one.
It's all about how much you care about the future. It's morality disguised as algebra.
So the source puts all this together. They have a formula for the optimal policy based on what they call the three Ds.
Right. First D is depreciation.
How long the CO2 stays in the air, which is, you know, thousands of years.
So it depreciates very, very slowly. The second D is damages.
That's the Nordhaus versus top-down fight. How much output do we lose per degree of warming?
And the third D is discounting, the moral choice, how we value the future.
And they actually ran a simulation with these, figure 25.6. It shows three possible futures for the planet.
Scenario A is no tax, business as usual.
And the result?
A 9 degrees Celsius temperature rise by the year 2200.
9 degrees? I mean, we just said 10 is uninhabitable. 9 is. That's the end of civilization as we know it.
It's catastrophic failure. But then look at scenario B, the optimal tax. It starts at around $25 per ton of CO2.
25 bucks a ton? That's what, like 25 cents on a gallon of gas? It's not nothing, but it's not economy killing.
It's manageable.
Yeah.
And in that scenario, warming stays around 2 degrees. We avoid the catastrophe.
Wow. Just by getting that price signal right.
And even scenario C, a really moderate tax of just $8 a ton, makes a huge difference compared to doing nothing. It shows that some price is dramatically better than no price.
So the argument isn't about shutting down the economy. It's about correcting a market failure.
Exactly. And the source makes it clear that whether you do that with a tax or with a cap and trade system.
Or you trade permits.
Mathematically, they're the same thing. One sets the price, the other sets the quantity. You get to the same place.
But there's a counter argument here, right? If you make energy more expensive, doesn't that just kill growth? Or does it trigger something else? I guess, can innovation save us?
That's the idea of directed technical change.
The source looks at what happened after the 1973 oil crisis.
It's the perfect natural experiment. Before 73, energy was dirt cheap. No one cared about fuel efficiency.
Of course not. Why would you?
But then the price went through the roof. And suddenly, patent applications for energy-saving tech just skyrocketed. Smaller cars, better insulation, you name it.
So necessity really is the mother of invention.
But it's directed invention. We get good at solving the problems we're forced to solve. Engineers and scientists, they follow the money.
So if a policy like that PAGU tax makes carbon expensive,
then innovation will pivot. The smartest people in the world will suddenly have a massive financial incentive to invent clean energy solutions.
So it's not just a punishment. It's a signal to every R&D department on the planet.
It's not just about using less. It's about inventing better.
Okay, so let's try and wrap this all up. We started with the basic problem.
The market feels the climate because no one owns the atmosphere. It's a free dumping ground.
Then we saw that we can't count on running out of fuel to save us. There's enough coal to completely ruin the planet.
So we need a policy correction, a PAGU tax, to price the damage into the cost of the fuel.
But the size of that tax depends on our own values, really, how much we care about the future.
And finally, that tax doesn't have to be impossibly high. It just has to be high enough to steer that giant ship of global innovation in a new green direction.
It's a story about incentives. From start to finish.
That's the optimistic view from the model, yes.
I do want to leave our listeners with one last thought, though. It's something that really stuck with me from that CCR section. The idea of irreversibility.
It's a haunting concept.
Most economic problems, you know, they fluctuate. Inflation goes up and down. Markets crash and they recover.
Right.
But this isn't like that. Every single ton of carbon we emit today stays in that atmospheric ledger for basically forever on a human time scale. There's no bailout for the climate.
It raises a pretty profound question. Does knowing the math, knowing it's linear and irreversible, make the choice we have to make easier? Or does it make the weight of our decisions right now almost too heavy to really comprehend?
Something to think about. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.
My pleasure.
See you next time.